On Tech News Today, did a gang of Russian hackers really grab more than a billion usernames and passwords? Plus, Apple and Samsung kiss and make up, sort of. And the people who run the Wikipedia say Europe's right to be forgotten violates human rights. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, August 6th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and tricasting the man behind the curtain today is Chad Johnson. OMG, Chad,
hey.
There he is. Never mind the man behind the curtain. I am the great and powerful anchor. And also joining us today is Sarah Silbert, our Wednesday co-anchor. Welcome. Wow, look at that painting behind you.
Yeah, I'm in San Diego. Get a little taste of Southern California, I guess.
There it is.
Me and my parents.
It's radical.
Yeah.
That's radical, man. Are you from San Diego originally?
I am originally, yeah.
Okay. I always pegged you for a New Yorker type. You live in New York now, right?
I do. Okay. Yeah. It's worn off on me, I guess. Or I've become a New Yorker over time.
It happens. It happened to me in the 90s. And I escaped somehow. So I'm back to California. Well, let's jump into the news. The New York Times reported yesterday that a gang of 20 or so Russian hackers has stockpiled some 1.2 billion usernames and passwords belonging to more than half a billion human beings. The report is based on claims made by a company called Hold Security, a Milwaukee-based firm founded last year. But several reporters have found problems with the story. For starters, the company won't reveal which sites were hacked unless they're paid for their so-called breach notification service, which started at $120 a month. But when a Wall Street Journal reporter asked questions about the services, Hold replaced their offer with a coming soon page and told the reporter that the fee has been reduced to $10 a month. It's all pretty wacky. Russell Brandom wrote about this story for The Verge and joins us now. Welcome, Russell.
Hi, great to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, first, let's start off with what Hold Security claimed. What do they say has happened exactly?
So they say they were tracking this group, Cybervor, which is their name. It's a great name. They said, you know, we've found they've been using a variety of methods and they've managed to assemble this database of 1.2 billion username password combinations. And 1.2 billion is sort of a bigger number than we've ever gotten in this context before. So it's a big deal. It sounds like a story. You can see sort of why the Times jumped on it.
So, Russell, what exactly was wrong with this initial round of reports in this story?
It was sort of presented in the context of being a single hack. Like, they did this one hack that got 1.2 billion. And, in the piece, it was compared to Adobe and Target, which were sort of instances of hackers breaking a single system and coming out with all of these things. But as you look closer, there are these sort of inconsistencies. So it wasn't a single, I mean, there were these, it was hundreds of thousands of sites. And it happened over the course of months. And it's not even clear that all of the information in this 1.2 billion database came from Cybervor's own actions. They didn't necessarily pull all of it out of the protected systems because you have, they talk about them purchasing information from other hackers. You can buy this information once it's been hacked. They certainly did some of that early, and it's sort of not really clear where the purchased data ends and the stolen data begins.
So specifically, Hold said that they hit 420,000 web addresses. And as you're pointing out, it's not clear how much of this was their own hacking efforts, how much of it was just purchased on the open market in these shady websites where people interact and where companies like Hold Securities find out these stories most likely. Now, have they used these usernames and addresses for anything yet?
this is the other weird thing. So in the Times piece, one of the really odd things is they say, well, they're not selling it, although they could. They're using it to hack Twitter accounts, which is a really weird thing if you're these fearsome hackers that have, you know, just pulled off the biggest hack in history. It's really odd that you would just use it to hack Twitter accounts to send spam. It's not that lucrative. It's not that sophisticated. It's just very low on the list of things you would do with this information once you had acquired it.
It's also a small number of users because 1.2 billion they claim, and then Twitter at best has a few hundred million users. So it would be at best a subset of their user base, even if they had every single Twitter username and password.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that, you know, I don't know the answer to why they're doing that, why they're focusing on Twitter hacking, but it does seem, it just sort of doesn't add up. There's something odd about it. It feels like there's something that Hold isn't telling us, or just that no one found out about CyberVore, but there are a lot of things about the story overall that feel like they don't really make sense.
Now, how credible to you is Hold Security?
Well, so they have done real, I mean, they're a legitimate firm. They aren't just some guys who walked in off the street. They did great stuff on the Adobe hack. And I think, you know, they're a very serious private security firm. But it's also true that any time a private security firm goes public with information like this, it's the incentive is always for them to make it sound very, very important and like they did something really significant, because the only reason for them to do this work is so that they get their name in the paper as sort of the heroic researchers who found this thing. So I think any time you're looking at a story that came entirely from a private security firm like this, you have to be a little bit skeptical of, is it really as big as they're telling us?
So would you say that this thing where they're asking people to pay as low as $120 to find out if they've been affected, is it this them trying to make this seem bigger to kind of capitalize on what they're reporting?
Well, I think that's their business. I mean, I think that is them saying, we were looking at Kashmir Hill's Forbes piece earlier, and she talked to them, and their explanation was basically, we spent a lot of money researching this, which they were researching it for, I think, 7 months. I mean, that's a lot of, you know, hours. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of money. And they're just saying, look, we need to recoup our investment, because otherwise, if we just did this for the sake of journalism, you know, we're in the hole for quite a lot of money on that. That doesn't make me feel a lot better about any, you know, I think that does make you wonder, like, especially because there is this sense, the first question anyone asks when they hear a story like this is, am I at risk personally? What should I be doing? Right? I mean, this is, you know, from readers, if you get call-in shows, this is what everyone asks. And the answer with this is, if they're just Twitter hacking, it doesn't really matter. Like, you get your Twitter account hacked and that's bad, but that's if all this stuff lines up. You were in the 1.2 billion accounts. You did use the same password in that thing that you used in Twitter, and they did eventually get in and start spamming you. Then, so there's a chance that if you're affected, they'll hack your Twitter account. That doesn't seem like worth $120 to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, and I think that point has sort of gotten lost because it's such a big number and otherwise such a scary story sort of at first glance. So that's sort of another thing where it doesn't really, it just doesn't add up.
Yeah. And of course, there's a certain amount of there's a kind of arms race between different security firms to outscare the others, because we all get sort of we are constantly bombarded with these scary hacks that are supposed to affect us. Our credit card information has been stolen. Our passwords have been stolen. Russian gangs. And so Hold Security actually punched it up a bit with a little tidbit. They said that the list of affected sites, quote, includes many leaders in virtually all industries across the world, as well as a multitude of small or even personal websites. So if you think about who would be included in that, that's vague enough to where just about anybody with money, the kind of money that would pay this kind of fee, you know, website owners, people who base their business on security of their website, and also prominent people of any kind in all industries, he says. You know, it's really a pretty aggressive drumming up of business to pay that fee. And so that's, you know, that's another shady thing about it. And that's the problem with these hacks. We talked about this yesterday, talking about the Target breach. You don't know how bad the hack is. We don't know how invalid these passwords are. Maybe most of them are from 10 years ago or something like that. We don't know anything about it. And you won't find that kind of information even if you pay the fee. They'll be able to give you limited information, presumably. But for the most part, it's just a big, you know, the business model is scare the pants off of everybody and get people to pay up. And this Hold Securities is not alone in that business model. Kind of an interesting story. And we're reporting scary, big, scary stories like this almost every single day. So it's a tough business to be in. It's hard to scare people who have been you know, bludgeoned with scary stories like this for years. And this is just the latest installment of that ongoing series. Well, Russell Brandom writes at TheVerge.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Russell Brandom. That is Brandom with an M at the end. Thank you so much for joining us, Russell.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, just a sec. We're going to talk about Apple and Samsung and their ongoing relationship, if you can call it that. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the most fantastic place on the internet to build a website of any kind. And the reason you want to build a website on Squarespace is severalfold, the first and foremost of which is that people will judge you. They'll judge your business. They'll judge everything that you're presenting on the internet by the appearance and the quality of your site. Squarespace exists to make sure your site looks as beautiful and as high performing as it can possibly be. And they make it beautiful through templates like Aviator, Front Row, and Pacific. These are specific branded templates that they have, and they have so many for you to choose from. And once you've chosen your template of choice, you can add your own photography, you can change the typefaces, you can add pages, you can customize it any way you like without any coding. Of course, if you are a coder, you can go in there and really modify it thoroughly to your heart's content. Both of those options are easy to do with Squarespace. And you can create a website in minutes. Just go there now. Go to Squarespace right now and try it. There's a free 2-week trial. There's no credit card required. You can just go, quick sign up, and build a website in a couple of minutes, and you'll see how fun it is to build a website on Squarespace. And by the way, if you're a blogger, you can import your blog from WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and other blogging sites. It's super easy to do. And once you have your blog on Squarespace, you can post. One of my favorite features, you can post by email. That's right. You send your website an email, and the email itself becomes the post. Super easy to do, and you can do it from anywhere. And, of course, there are mobile apps that Squarespace offers that let you both manage your site and manage your blog. So no matter what kind of site you have, you can manage it on the go from your mobile device. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So here's what we'd like you to do. Start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website right now. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you a discount of 10% off. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Sarah Silbert, looks like Apple and Samsung have kind of, sort of kissed and made up.
Kind of, sort of, the key word there. So obviously these two companies have been fighting over patents in court for what seems like forever, but they've just come to an agreement to drop all legal action outside the United States. To tell us more, we have Shara Tipkin. She's a senior writer from CNET. Shara, thank you for joining us. Can you start off by telling us why both parties were just suddenly to stop, willing to drop litigation? This affects several countries outside the U.S., correct?
8 or 9 countries outside the U.S. They basically, there were no clear winners internationally. Here, even things were kind of mixed. In the United States, Apple has won about $1 billion. You know, they also owe Samsung a little bit. You know, this is nothing near what they wanted from this, from these suits. But internationally, you know, there's been a little bit of difference and, you know, no clear winners, and it's just kind of distracting, I think. So it was time for them to finish these.
Now, of course, Apple and Samsung have long had a weird relationship because they both compete with each other in each company's most lucrative market, the smartphone industry plus tablets and so on. But at the same time, Samsung is a major part supplier to Apple. and they have to kind of work together. They can't always be at odds with each other. And so as part of the kind of warmer and fuzzier version of Apple since Tim Cook took over, you know, they've been kind of going through all these different areas where Apple has been kind of hostile to this company, that company, and so on. And this seems to be one example. Now, do you think, Shara, that this is a harbinger of a complete settling of all their legal differences? I mean, they have some pretty naughty N-O-T-T-Y. K-N-O-T-T-Y. That's not the N-word. Anyway, they have some pretty thorny, I should say, court cases in the U.S. over patents and so on. They do not disagree on those things. There's lots of money at stake. And so do you think that they'll be able to settle those anytime soon?
I think that they're going to keep trying to fight those out for at least a while. You know, these we've been through two trials, a damages retrial. You know, these are there's still motions going on in the last trial. You know, those aren't even being appealed yet. So, you know, I think that they're going to keep fighting those for at least a while, but eventually they're going to have to settle these because, you know, they could just keep dragging on. You know, I think basically the companies would be willing to take these to the Supreme Court, but whether the Supreme Court would hear them is another matter. So, you know, I think everyone's hoping that these settle relatively soon.
Yeah, I mean it's funny because they really don't they really don't do very well in court. Neither company gets what they want. When the last time they went to court, basically Apple wanted, you know, huge amounts of money, and they got almost nothing. They wanted the court to essentially ban certain phones. They did not get that. So Apple isn't getting what they want. Samsung isn't getting what they want. The court case has given both companies, I think, a fairly bad reputation. It gives Apple a bad reputation because they are perceived as a bully who uses the courts instead of the open market to compete with Samsung. And Samsung looks good because, in fact, the courts generally rule more or less in favor of Apple in terms of the claim that Samsung violates Apple patents. And so it's just awful for both companies. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem to help either company. And so it seems to me that they really should sort of let this kind of thing go. Now, will this basically affect, do you think, the settling of their court cases internationally? Will this help Samsung? I mean, they had a pretty rough earnings report. Will this help them financially in any sort of material way?
I don't really think so. I mean, they're spending millions and millions of dollars on litigation, you know, and whether that's happening here or in Japan or Australia, you know, and that is just peanuts to these companies. You know, they're spending tons of money, but they're making, you know, billions of dollars a year. I think this just allows Samsung to kind of refocus internationally. So instead of having to worry about fighting these battles, they can just worry about competing with the, you know, the low-end Chinese handset vendors who are really, you know, giving them a hard time right now. You know, even like Lenovo's of the world, Huawei, ZTE. So I think that's where Samsung's going to face a lot of competition going forward is from these low-cost guys in places like China and India.
That's a good point. Shara Tipkin writes at CNET.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Shara Tipkin. Thank you so much for joining us, Shara.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, the Chinese government appears to be increasing its crackdown on American technology companies. The government's now banned Apple products such as iPads and MacBooks from being purchased by any Chinese government agency. Plus, Chinese antitrust authorities conducted new raids on the Chinese offices of Microsoft and Accenture. They raided Microsoft offices just last month as part of their launch of an antitrust investigation against the company. And a Hong Kong court also ruled that a local tycoon can sue Google for defamation because of the autocomplete results that pop up in a Google search for the man's name. Are you sensing this, Sarah Silbert, that this sort of ongoing attack by the Chinese government against foreign and especially U.S. technology companies, or is this just a coincidence that all these things tend to be happening at once?
Oh, no, it's definitely a pattern here. I mean, like you said, this is not just Apple. Several security companies as well, Symantec, Kaspersky, Microsoft. I mean, it's kind of a hard to avoid these companies. So this is definitely not just some coincidence, I would say.
Yeah, and Apple, of course, depends on China for about 16% of its revenue. I'd give it 2 years before that's about 30 or 40%. China is obviously a super important market, and China's been going after Apple pretty hard in a number of ways. Their official state-owned media keeps hammering away at Apple for basically trumped-up charges that don't add up to anything. But they're also going after other companies as well. Microsoft said in May that it was surprised to learn that Windows 8 was excluded from the government procurement because of Windows XP. That was a weird story, and it still holds. It's still not on the list of allowable things that you can buy. Of course, you can. Microsoft has rampant piracy problems in China, including among the Chinese government. So they'll be using Windows 8. It just won't be one purchased by Microsoft, most likely. Qualcomm, even in November, disclosed an investigation in China against China's anti-monopoly law. They were accused of being a monopolist, abusing their monopoly power. Qualcomm, that's right. And of course, they're a major component manufacturer for a lot of Chinese products. And it just goes on and on. We cover some of these on this show, but it's just clear that China's going after U.S. Companies all over the place. Now, this Hong Kong case is really kind of weird. Albert Yung Sao Xing is the founder and chairman of Hong Kong, a Hong Kong-based company called Emperor Group. He's quite a big shot in Hong Kong. And when you search for his name in Google in Hong Kong, you get the autocomplete options that drop down, which are a source of hilarity for all kinds of searches. But one of the words that pops up when you search for his name is Triad. Triad is a reference to Chinese gang. And so he is suing them because that word shows up in the autocomplete. Now, if a precedent is set, Sarah, that the content of the autocomplete is a legitimate basis for a lawsuit, then that's trouble, because that means lots of people will sue things. I mean, you put any prominent person's name into a search engine, you're going to get some wacky autocompletes, and that's based entirely on the actions of users. So to a certain extent, this is related to Europe's right to be forgotten ruling, which we're going to be talking about very soon, in the sense that this is the legitimate. Now you see it, you even see it in the English language one there as the second autocomplete option, but this is related to the European right to be forgotten because this is the legitimate actions of an objective search engine doing what it does, and now you potentially have a government that may step in and say, look, you have to alter this for this person or whoever it is that sues or complains, and essentially changing the search engine to be less than accurate or less than consistent with how it treats different people and different searches. So it's kind of an odd thing. Do you think this is going to let up anytime soon, Sarah Silbert, or is this an ongoing problem that we're going to be dealing with from China?
It definitely seems to be ramping up, getting more intense. Like you said, this last example of Google somehow coming under fire for something that, you know, seems so counterintuitive. This is what Google is for. It's this open internet with search results. It's not necessarily curating things. So I think this is all an indication that this isn't going away anytime soon. It'll be interesting to see if more companies get added to the list, what's going to happen in the next few months.
Well, in another story, Google has been the poster child for Europe's right to be forgotten fiasco, but now Wikipedia is stepping forward and saying that the right to be forgotten is violating everyone's right to remember. What's going on there, Sarah?
Right. So the Wikimedia Foundation is basically calling this censorship. Today it posted details for 5 notices of removal that have affected more than 50 links and pages on Wikipedia's site. Obviously, this relates back to Google. We have Brian Fung, a reporter from The Washington Post, here to tell us more. Brian, thank you for joining us. So can you just tell us exactly what happened, how Google is relating to all of this, and did it let Wikipedia know what exactly happened here?
Right. So the notices that were given by Google to Wikipedia were simply telling them that, hey, this is something that we're doing. Wikipedia didn't really have any options or choice in the matter, given that Google has to comply with this law in Europe. So, you know, what the notices reveal is that Google has basically scrubbed a set of links in search results to Wikipedia sites and pages. Now, what Wikipedia is saying is that this is something that Google did of its own volition, and that's great, but that other search engines may not be so forthcoming, and that's potentially a problem.
And of course, Google gets Wikipedia gets the lion's share of their traffic, probably from Google search, I'm imagining. One of the people that has been expunged, according to this ruling, is an Italian gangster by the name of Renato Valenzasca. And another one is a convicted criminal named Jerry Hutch. Essentially, what they're doing is they're using the right to be forgotten to remove links to the Wikipedia. Now, this is super problematic because if you, a person's life, if somebody is in the Wikipedia, there's lots and lots of information about that person. If they're a famous person for whatever reason, they've been in the newspapers in their own country or globally, they're a famous person. They have, you know, typically goes into their childhood, their families, their history, their careers, different facts about that person. And the Wikipedia is a super valuable resource, a kind of a chronicle of what has been publicly presented on the internet. And when the right to be forgotten says that, okay, when you search for this person's name, you don't get the link to Wikipedia, you're not just sort of erasing or cleansing the internet of the facts that they're trying to erase, such as their criminal histories or alleged criminal histories or whatever it is, you're erasing the entire link to that person's biography, essentially, as it's generally found on the internet. So that is super, super problematic. That's my own opinion. Brian Fung, you follow this kind of thing very closely. What's your opinion? Do you think that Wikipedia has a good point here?
Well, I think this has kind of exposed one of the interesting things about the right to be forgotten debate. I mean, until now, we've sort of mostly discussed it in the context of Google without really realizing that this actually has implications sort of by definition for companies that are connected to Google in all sorts of ways. And so, you know, while the content that Wikipedia is hosting is still there, you can get to it if you navigate to it manually. That's not going to be available to anyone who's searching on Google in Europe. And so obviously that's going to be very problematic for anyone who's trying to do research or trying to sort of understand more about a subject that they're interested in. Sarah was pointing out, this is, Wikipedia is saying that this is akin to censorship. And a lot of news organizations stand to be affected by this too.
Yes, they do. Absolutely. And there's some really interesting facts in all this. But before we get to those interesting and hilarious facts in one case, there's an executive director for the Wikimedia Foundation. Of course, Wikimedia is the foundation that runs the Wikipedia, who says that the right to be forgotten creates memory holes, Orwellian memory holes. That is a great phrase, Orwellian memory holes. That's probably going to be a candidate for our for our show title here. But she points out that accurate search results are vanishing in Europe with, quote, no public explanation, no real proof, no judicial review, and no appeals process. That pretty much sums it up very nicely. Now, a good example of what the response to the right to be forgotten should be, the Wikimedia Foundation has pointed out that between July 2012 and July 2014, Wikimedia received 304 requests for content to be removed or altered, and they didn't grant a single one. And some of the examples are extremely colorful. For example, a Tasmanian Aboriginal Language Center demanded the removal of the English language article on Palawamani, which is, I guess, the language itself, because they argued that they owned or copyrighted the entire language. But the most hilarious one, of course, was that they had a request by a photographer who wanted a picture of a monkey removed. The photographer had set up a camera with a certain apparatus in the forest or whatever that could be activated by the monkey. So the monkey would come up and pound on the camera and essentially take selfies. He posted these pictures somewhere. They ended up in the Wikipedia, and he requested that they remove them because they didn't have permission to post them. And the Wikipedia declined, saying that the monkey owned the copyright. So that is great. That is a great detail in all of this. Now, what do you think is next for this? Do you think that we're going to face a situation anytime soon where Google will be persuaded by the Wikimedia's claim here and actually restore these links?
Well, I think it's important to point out here that Google is simply obeying a European law. So there's not a whole lot other than petitioning the legal system for Google to actually fight against this.
Part of the problem with this is that they're being charged with interpreting whether or not the information serves a public good. So, for example, to expunge a link to the Wikipedia on a convicted criminal That sounds to me like a judgment call, and it sounds to me like they made the wrong judgment call. Now, I don't have all the facts. Maybe I would change my mind if I knew everything that Google knows. But part of the rotten part of this is that Google is actually not just following the law. They have to interpret. They're the judge and jury in these things.
Yeah, I think, Mike, you've definitely hit on an important point. What's really interesting about that is that, you know, this is kind of an extension of you know, companies like Facebook or Google, who have historically taken it upon themselves to moderate things like hate speech or you know, racially charged content on their services, and now this is sort of the next level of that, where they're sort of you know, actually taking matters into their own hands when it comes to what is you know, what is displayed to people, even members of the general public who are not you know, day-to-day, you know, power users of the site. So this is definitely raises some really interesting ethical questions for Google moving forward, and for other search engines too, who, you know, may operate in different ways compared to Google and may have different policies.
Brian Fung writes prolifically at WashingtonPost.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Brian_Fung. Thank you so much for joining us again, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, BlackBerry said today that its device management service, which supports Android and iOS devices, has been granted a major security clearance from the Pentagon. Sarah Silbert, we covered a story yesterday showing that maybe BlackBerry has bottomed out. The layoffs may be ending. The financial picture may be turning around, and there's some suggestion that they may be profitable by March, which is the end of their fiscal year. But this is fantastic news because the Pentagon is a major, major fan of the BlackBerry platform. They're also a fan of messing around with iOS and Android devices. They're never really sure which one they want to standardize on. But BlackBerry provides this integrated, secure solution for BlackBerry's iOS devices and Android devices, and the Pentagon is probably going to gobble this thing up, and that'll be great for their business. Or I could be wrong about that. What do you think? Do you think this will make any difference in their fortunes?
No, I think this is absolutely great news for BlackBerry. Obviously, the Pentagon has a long time been a really strong supporter. Things could be looking up for the company. I mean, as you said, this is going to work with iOS Android devices. So especially since those devices are already so popular, bringing BlackBerry's enterprise technology to the table is definitely a very positive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a subtle kind of unmeasurable aspect to this, which is that if the Pentagon, in fact, does, now that they have the security clearance, buy up this solution, that's going to create a cascading ripple of app developers creating apps for the military and the Pentagon, and which will create a lot of interest around BlackBerry and so on. So this could be very, very good for BlackBerry. And, you know, so this is really, really great news coming on yesterday's memo from the CEO of BlackBerry saying that things appear to be turning around. So they're probably relatively happier than they've been in quite a while over there in Waterloo, Ontario. Well, Sarah, it looks like we're finally getting a date for this year's iPhone rollout.
Yes, this is news from Recode, actually. They are saying that the next big Apple event will be on September 9th. Based on timing and what has happened in years past, it's pretty clear this will be when we'll see the latest iPhones. And we're expecting these to come right after the big Samsung Galaxy Note unveil, which happens in Berlin. And Apple is rumored to definitely be having larger devices, larger screen sizes this time around. We've heard anything from 4.7 inches to 5.5 inches, but definitely that could make it, maybe the Galaxy Note announcement not have as big of an effect, because obviously Apple announcements always take over the whole news cycle.
Yeah, and of course, even the hype leading up to the announcement will probably erase a lot of attention from the Samsung event. That was probably no accident. There's a lot of controversy about whether or not they're going to come out with a big one, the 5.5-inch one that has been rumored. My personal prediction is that they'll announce and ship the smaller one, ship it within the next 2 weeks after the announcement, but that the 5.5-inch device will come later in the year. There's no way that if they're going to ship a 5.5-inch iPhone this year that they wouldn't mention it and talk about it, because they would be accused of just being shamelessly trying to get everybody to buy the small one and then come out with a new one right after that. They've done something like that before with the iPad, but that's my prediction. What do you think? Do you believe the two iPhone strategy, and do you think that's going to happen this year?
kind of agree with you. I think that it would probably play it safe with announcing a kind of more in-between size first, or launching that first, kind of feeling things out. But definitely it's been a long time coming that we've been expecting a larger screen size. So that in itself is very exciting, which I think we can pretty much agree is going to happen this time.
Well, in just a second, we're going to tell you about some good news coming from the Android Wear universe. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring people, if you're hiring manager, if you own a small business, you've got to hire the right people, and they're hard to hire. The economy is good now, and the jobs picture is good, which is great, but that makes it harder to hire good people because they apparently already have good jobs. So the very few people left over, you want to make sure you grab them and not allow your competitors to get them instead. How do you do it? ZipRecruiter. You can post your job to 50-plus job boards with a single click. Plus, you can sweep the social networks and get the job recruits that are lingering there automatically. It's super easy to use. At ZipRecruiter, you can view, download, and print and share resumes with colleagues, which is really nice. You can also customize your job boards to with your own company's graphics and logos and so on. So it looks very, very professional, even if you're a very small business. You don't have to juggle emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. And remember, it's super important to hire the right person. The best people are scattered all over the internet, and that's what ZipRecruiter specializes in, is making you cast a very wide net so you get the very best people to hire for your company. Now, right now, Tech News Today listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Charging has always been a major issue and differentiator for Android Wear watches. So far, the LG G watch that I'm wearing right here has offered more hassle-free charging than the Samsung Gear Live. These are the only two Android Wear watches currently on the market, but we just got a glimpse into the Moto 360 charging system. The Moto 360, of course, is Motorola's Android Wear watch, which stole the show at Google I.O. The Italian publication Mr. Gadget took a bunch of pictures of the Moto 360 in its included cradle. Chad, let's take a look at those pictures of the Moto 360 and its cradle.
This is a very popular story because, unfortunately, oh, there we go. We just got it all loaded in. Perfect.
Probably our audience going and hammering the site in advance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whenever we start to talk about a story, the chat room explodes with links and stuff where they are guessing what it's going to be. So there it is. It looks pretty cool. It's wireless charging, goes in the little cradle. Now, Jason Howell, of course, has the Samsung. I have the LG G watch, and he had problems with the Samsung because it's very difficult to get in and out. He actually accidentally damaged the watch trying to get it in and out of the cradle, and he's been complaining about it. This looks pretty nice, where you just put it into the cradle and it charges without it actually being locked into any sort of thing, nothing to plug in. So, you know, we knew there would be wireless charging. We saw early rumors, and when people were fondling the samples at Google I.O., you could see that there was some sort of charging metal at the bottom and no port for anything to be plugged in. It's a good looking watch. Look at that. Wow. Very nice.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It looks like that button on the side has changed quite a bit. It used to be something that looked like you could pull out.
You are absolutely right. It had a sort of a head on it. It was like, if you looked at it at an angle, it was a T-shaped. Now it's like there's a circle thing at the bottom. It looks more elegant and less likely to catch on things.
Absolutely.
Good observation, Chad. Thank you so much for that. We also learned in the same post that the Moto 360 is made of stainless steel, and best of all, it's going to be waterproof and dustproof. Plus, it'll have a heart rate sensor on the back, just like the Samsung does. And that is probably pretty important. I think that all the major watches are going to have at least a heart rate monitor, if not other sensors. People are expecting the rumored Apple iWatch, to have lots of sensors. Current rumor, I believe, is 11 sensors in it for biometric sensing and other things. So pretty cool. Can't wait to get one. They're going to, of course, send everyone who went to Google I.O. one for us to try out, and I'll be trying one out. And we'll tell you all about it as soon as we get our greedy little hands on it. Well, that is the tech news today. Sarah Silbert, you are leaving us. What's happening with your career?
I am. I'm very sad to leave you guys, but I'm taking a little bit of a different path, leaving tech journalism for now. So it's been great. Wish I could have been with you longer.
Well, we have lots and lots of shows here at Twit, and you've always been a great guest and a great host as well. So hopefully we'll get you on either this show or other shows for one reason or another. We'll come up with an excuse if we don't have one that falls on our lap. But thank you so much for all of your co-anchoring and on everything else. And we've enjoyed following you on Engadget. And good luck in your new career change.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS. So many ways to subscribe. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. Or you can just subscribe to TNT using the podcast app of your choice. Why not? Follow us on Twitter. Tech News Today TV is our Twitter name. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Boom. That was, I think, the best hit I had.